From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about the big questions in science, and my guest is Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of the journal Science in Washington, D.C. And now we're going to turn to a rather interesting new development in something that may provide some of the answers to some of the big questions, and it has to do with a comet. The comet is Tempel 1, and our guest is Michael Ahern. He's the principal investigator for the Deep Impact mission. That's the one that sent a large probe pummeling into the comet earlier this week, and a flash that literally was seen from millions of miles away, including telescopes here on Earth, I believe, but Dr. Ahern will clear us up on that. He's a professor of astronomy at the University of Maryland in College Park, and he joins me today from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where the mission is being controlled. Welcome, Dr. Ahern.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. And boy, this has been one heck of a week for you, huh?
It sure has. It's been incredibly hectic and incredibly exciting.
We talked to Dr. Yeomans last week when everybody was, you know, we were in the nail-biting stage. But the probe was pretty much right on target, wasn't it?
It was absolutely on target. It hit in an ideal position for us to view what happened from the flyby spacecraft. We couldn't have asked for more in delivering the impactor onto the comet.
Although you had to do a little bit of last-minute tweaking of the trajectory, from what I read.
Well, the impactor itself was pre-programmed to do a few maneuvers, and it had a very robust scheme for picking an area that would be well sunlit and would be biased towards the side where the flyby would look at it. And that algorithm, which was all autonomous, seems to have worked perfectly.
So, we're talking this hour about the big questions in science. What was the big question that Deep Impact was intended to address?
Well, there were two big questions. What's the difference in the composition inside and outside the comet? In other words, how much has the surface changed due to heating by sunlight? And how is the comet put together? Because both of those questions place constraints on how the planets formed 4.5 billion years ago, the comets being the pieces that went together to make the cores of all the giant planets, Jupiter out to Neptune. And we were trying to, we had a spectrometer to look at the composition, and we have imagers that study the impact event. We've already got some answers, but clearly there's a tremendous amount of data analysis yet to be done before we get to all the answers.
So what kind of, what are you able to analyze? You see a big flash of light, and what do you see in that flash that enables you to understand the answers to the questions you're looking for?
Well, for example, what we look at is the debris that's excavated from the crater, and that forms a cone. And if the cone seems to stay attached to the surface all the way through the event, that tells us the material is very weak. It has almost no strength. If the cone lifts up off the surface, that tells us it has a lot of strength. Now, when we turned around from the backside and looked back at the nucleus, it appeared that the cone was still attached to the surface up to 90 minutes later. And that tells us that the material is extremely weak, much, and in fact weaker probably than the limits that were obtained from the fact that Jupiter could pull apart comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 by tidal effects.
Huh. And so what does that tell you about the origin of the solar system?
Well, that tells us that when things came together in the early solar system, they did not come together at high enough velocity. They didn't come together hard enough or get squeezed enough to, for example, melt and connect the tiny microscopic particles together with the strength of ice. That is the first obvious conclusion. Now, clearly it's going to be a long time before we work out any more details than that very qualitative assessment.
I got it. Okay. Dr. Kennedy, do you think I should extract a promise from you now to publish all this exciting data when it's finally ready for publication?
Well, I'm very hesitant about prior promises, but we'd love to see it. We would surely love to see it. I have a little policy sidebar on that. I think that's a huge triumph of robotic space exploration, like Cassini, like the Mars Explorers. But we now have a major human exploration project announced, and NASA is now trying to put together its priorities in the face of a huge new expenditure and see how much of these important robotic missions it can still afford. And I think that's a deep question, and it's producing some morale problems at NASA.
Right. Right. Dr. Ahern, yours was one of the I think I remember, one of these smaller, faster, easier spacecraft to be put together. It was a smaller project anyway, as these
smaller
projects go.
Yes, smaller and faster, but definitely not easier.
Okay. But, is this the kind of thing, do you think this is the reward, the scientific reward for this is going to be as large as Dr. Kennedy thinks?
Oh, I think absolutely. There are a few kinds of science that are better done by humans in space, but not very many. And having the humans in space is important for inspiration, but the science is far more cost-effectively done in most cases with robotic missions.
Right. And what can this mission, the Deep Impact mission, talk about how life arose on Earth? Is there any connection there?
Well, many of us, although certainly not all of us, think that comets delivered most of the water and all the organic material to the Earth that enabled life to exist here. There was some contribution undoubtedly from primitive asteroids in the outer part of the asteroid belt, but many of us think that the cometary contribution was the dominant one. So anything we can learn about the nature of comets will tell us about the nature of the material that was brought to Earth to enable life.
Okay. We have a comet question, I think, from Don in Rockford, Michigan. Is it, Don? Welcome to the program.
Sir. Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
I apologize, I'm terrible with names, but the gentleman from NASA, is it?
Michael Ahern. No, he's from the University of Maryland, but he's working with NASA on this mission.
I just wanted to congratulate you. This was a spectacular mission.
Thank you.
I've been following this one and Huygens. You were involved in Huygens as well, weren't you, on the imaging team?
No, I was not on Huygens at all.
Oh, okay. Then I'm nuts. In any case, I wondered a couple of things. One, the fact that we didn't get a really good picture of the impact crater going to affect the data that you get back from this.
Well, the fact that we didn't get, at least we haven't yet gotten a good picture of the impact crater, is interesting in itself. It says that the amount of material that came out of the crater was in much finer particles than many of us had expected, and therefore it was much brighter and much more opaque, so that we were looking through a reasonably thick cirrus cloud in order to see the crater. So although we don't have the crater, we have alternative information that is equally interesting.
And when you said yet, I'm just sorry, I want to, if you don't mind, Don, there's hope for getting one of these pictures still?
We're still working on trying to extract an image of the crater. We know exactly where the impactor went in from the images on the impactor itself. So we know exactly where on the nucleus to look. And it requires very high signal-to-noise ratio in the images and then very careful processing to find something through this cloud of material. So what we're working on right now is improving the calibration of the images to remove some additional noise. And I think there is still hope that of us getting an image of the crater. It won't be a really spectacular sharp image because of the cloud of dust in front of it, but we are still optimistic that we will get a picture eventually.
And Don, you had one other question?
Yes, sir. This is probably more for Dr. Kennedy, but a general question about astronomy and physics. I haven't had a chance to see your list yet. Is there anybody considering the issue of entropy?
Well, I think
Don, I'm sorry. Sorry, our caller Don is breaking up, so I'm going to just see if we can move on to getting Dr. Kennedy's answer, if you can address that.
Well, I think physicists think about entropy, or physicists and physical chemists think about the entropy all the time. I don't think there's a particular project aimed at some particular target.
Okay. I think we have time for one more comet-related question. Mike in St. Louis, welcome to the program. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good.
First of all, I'm really grateful to be a human being and vulnerable as such, but why are we trying to send human beings into outer space when clearly we're heading towards virtuality, and that's a real issue for the future, is who we're going to be and how we're going to achieve this transition. But spending money into the future to send humans into outer space to just do observations, I think, is a ridiculous waste of money. And I'd like your comment from anybody there who might want to address that.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Why don't I put Dr. Ahern on the spot? You already sort of answered this by talking about the symbolism of men in space, or humans in space, I should say.
Yeah, I think there is an important aspect to human exploration. So I think the real question is, what fraction of NASA's budget do you spend on it? I think we learn more from the robotic science, but the human role has to be there eventually. And I think it is perfectly reasonable to spend a fraction of NASA's budget on human exploration, but human exploration means going places, and
yep.
Then I think we should be spending a very large fraction of the budget on the robotic missions, which tell us our place in the universe.
Okay. Well, Dr. Ahern, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm sure this is an exciting time, and I'm glad that you took the time out to talk with us before you race back to the control room or wherever you're doing the analysis.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye. Michael Ahern is principal investigator for the Deep Impact Mission and a professor of astronomy at the University of Maryland in College Park. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking for the rest of the hour with Donald Kennedy. He's the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine in Washington, D.C. And I was going to ask you, Dr. Kennedy, has science taken an editorial position on this question of whether, you know, the human space program is the right way to be spending the nation's money?
I sign the editorials on this particular subject at Science, and the editorial position has been simply this. We've got a huge new program to send people to Mars via the moon. Obviously, there's excitement in that adventure because, after all, exploration is part of the human narrative. On the other hand, it's going to cost a great deal of money, and there are a lot of explorations that are primarily robotic that are planned for both planetary science and for explorations of deep space, to which, by the way, we will never plan to send anybody, at least not in the foreseeable future, because if they go out there, they're not coming back.
Yeah.
The planetary explorations, obviously attract the interest of people who are excited by human exploration. The question is, how much money do you want to divert from other things to pay for that? And I think that's a tough question, and it's bothering a lot of people at NASA.
But let's go one step beyond that. The balance is interesting between physical research and biological research. I mean, even an inexpensive mission in NASA terms is several hundred million dollars, and there's a lot of biological research that can be done for that amount of money. So how do you feel that balance is?
Well, let me stick with NASA and NASA work for a moment, because, in fact, one of the projects that has been talked about for some time is Earth observing satellites and an Earth observation program. We can learn a lot about the biology that happens in the skin of our own Earth, And that's one of the projects that may well be in jeopardy as a consequence of the cost of the new Mars mission.
So, but more generally, even than that, is the balance, if you were looking at the U.S. science scene, I mean, we've just signed on, for example, to ITER, this international thermonuclear fusion generator. These are huge, expensive projects, and of course we all remember the superconducting supercollider, which was going to answer fundamentally important questions, but we decided we couldn't afford it. Are we missing something in our balance of research dollars because we see some projects as very expensive and others being, you know, smaller and easier to fund?
I think we've done pretty well at maintaining a balance in the past. I have some skepticism about big fusion expenditures, but others think it's very worthwhile. I'm not smart enough to know. The real difficulty, it seems to me, is deciding how to allocate between basic research and more applied projects. That's one kind of allocation trauma. And the other is to decide between big project science and small project science. And we're getting more and more interdisciplinary. I think that came out earlier in the show. And as that happens, more and more work requires teams, and more work requires fairly substantial facilities allocations. And so maintaining that balance is difficult. I think we've done a reasonably good job of it in the past. But there will always be some competition between the investigator-initiated, independent, smaller research projects that have yielded a good deal in the past and big project work.
Okay, Donald Kennedy, that's where we have to leave things. Thanks very much for joining me.
It was a pleasure, Joe.
Donald Kennedy is editor-in-chief of the journal Science in Washington, D.C. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Rigo Cardi in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinh. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. For internet mail, it's scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you from the iTunes Music Store. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum material for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on the teacher's link on sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.